Hello and welcome to a bonus episode of Fully Scored. Avid listeners will be aware that over the past three episodes, staff bandsman Jonathan Evans has treated us to a trilogy of analyses on Ray Steadman Allen's Victorian Snapshots on Ratcliffe Highway. In this episode, we've stitched all three parts of those analyses together to form one continuous deep dive. Well, I say we've stitched it together. Actually, it was recorded in one session, and we spliced it up from there. So here is the original, or the spliced and restitched version, whichever you'd like to call it. Throughout the analysis, we've punctuated with excerpts of music. For this, we've used a combination of the YBS recording from Essays for Brass and the ISB recording from Origins. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us once again on Fully Scored for your third and hopefully not last appearance. Today you're going to be introducing us to the grand musical portrait of Victorian Britain, that is Ray Steadman Allen's masterpiece, On Ratcliffe Highway. Before we talk about the music itself, can you tell us a little bit about the inspiration behind the work?
Hi Matthew, great to be on the podcast again. Yes, of course. And I want to take you back to 1878, Salisbury in the United Kingdom, and an appeal was made for some bodyguards to protect the Salvationists who were gathering to preach and worship in the open-air marketplace. And at that time, they were attracting some opposition. They needed some protection. This call was answered by four members of the Fry family who pitched up with their brass instruments and offered security to the gathered group as they preached a somewhat unpopular message against the injustices of evil. And so Salvation Army bands were born. Fast forward 100 years to 1978, and Ray Steadman Allen was commissioned to write a major work to be simultaneously premiered by the International Staff Band and the Melbourne Staff Band at the International Congress. It was designed to mark a century of Salvation Army banding, and so there was a need for celebration and some nostalgia too. RSA was inspired by the front cover of the War Cry from Saturday, May the 15th, 1886, which featured an artistic impression of an Easter campaign held by Whitechapel soldiers marching through the Ratcliffe Highway. The sketch shows many buglers, timbrelists and soldiers marching forwards with their flag and banners aloft, surrounded by pubs, sailors, chimney smoke, ship masts in the distance and countless folks watching on from street level and hanging out of windows. Inspirational stuff for a composer of RSA's rare creativity, for sure. Now, what I'd not seen before was the article that accompanied the sketch, titled Great Doings at Whitechapel, authored by the Joyful Major. The feats detailed in this article are extraordinary. Thousands on the march, a suicide prevented, women lifted from prostitution, and 500 people following the 400-strong band back to the Whitechapel Corps Hall for tea. So here are some quotes from the War Cry article by the Joyful Major. I saw on Saturday night, on the 24th of April, that the first corps of the Salvation Army was alive and meant to make everybody know it. And there was a real ring about the song and testimony. I'm presuming that must be Poplar Corps that he's referencing there. Let's learn a little bit more then about what happened on this Easter weekend. Another quote says, at night we had souls crying for mercy. One poor woman wept much. And when I spoke to her, she said she had given up hope. Drink had ruined her. She'd lost her best friends. She'd lost her home and her character was gone. And in despair and determined to throw herself into the river, but hearing our music and singing, it seemed to say, come back to God. God can make you happy. And thank God she came to the barracks and to the feet of Jesus. So a suicide prevented there by the witness of these Salvationists. 400 soldiers with two bands were the order of the march in the afternoon, and as we played and sang Salvation through the back slums of the East End, I saw sights which forced tears into my eyes and produced feelings in my soul unutterable. Thousands of men and women lost to virtue, lost to shame, lost to decency, with the mark of the beast so plainly written upon their foreheads that no one could mistake whose they were. As we marched, the crowd gathered until when we were entering Ratcliffe Highway, we were headed by six rows of five in a row. So there is a little bit from the article. I think the image will be known to many, but perhaps not some of those quotes from the Joyful Major in 1886. So the area that's being referenced there in the article, that Dockland area in London, RSA visited that area and quickly conjured a vivid picture of the colourful, cosmopolitan and decadent East End of the 1880s.
So what can you actually tell us about Ratcliffe Highway itself? Is this music based on a real location?
The highway is still there today in East London, running into central London, and part of it was formerly known as Ratcliffe Highway. It's a road in the London borough of Tower Hamlets, and it's less than 2 miles from the location of William Booth's first public meeting at Mile End back in 1865. Now, the road actually dates back all the way to Roman times, but in the 19th century, it had a reputation for vice and crime and was the location of the infamous Ratcliffe Highway murders of the Marr family in 1811. By the late 19th century, the highway had acquired a mythological status across London as a centre of all kinds of criminal activity, drunkenness and wild behaviour, fuelled by the thousands of sailors from all over the world that poured into the area from the nearby docks of Limehouse. Charles Dickens, that great Victorian writer, said this about it: "Ratcliffe Highway was one of the sights of the metropolis and almost unique in Europe as a scene of coarse riot and debauchery." This Dickensian vision of London, then, was a weary place of opium dens, wild animal emporiums, complete with rampaging escaped tigers from said emporiums, prostitution, squalid poverty and violent crime typified by the 1888 Whitechapel murders, better known by the name of their mystery perpetrator, Jack the Ripper. In RSA's words, it was a crowded, dissolute and degraded dockside slum with gin palaces and sailors' lodging houses. Charles Booth, who was a doyen of Victorian philanthropic social reformers, unrelated to the founder of the Salvation Army, mapped London's poverty in 1889 and revealed 35% of the East End were living in poverty, with half of the residents of Ratcliffe Highway, which had by then been renamed St George's Street, living in the most extreme levels of poverty in London. These people were outcasts, the lowest, vicious and semi-criminal, to quote Charles Booth. Naturally, several Christian missions attempted to improve living conditions and ultimately to save souls, including the Salvation Army, often in the face of great resistance from groups like the Skeleton Army. The Skeletons had their own banners, insignia and songs and attacked Salvationists in 21 towns and cities across the UK. So I think to understand RSA's music fully and in depth, we need to appreciate the context of the Victorian East End and the birth of the Salvation Army and its banding movement too.
Thank you so much for giving us that context there. Really fascinating to hear about that time of history. I guess we and none of our listeners have probably seen. So thank you for taking us into that. What about the musical context?
So how for RSA to respond to the image and to that article? Clearly something to represent the brave band, the singers, the timbrelists. And to an extent, this had really been done. If you look at Henry Goffin's quite novel Salvation Army Patrol, written in 1930, that depicts a Salvation Army band marching as if from the distance, getting louder and louder before passing and diminuending as they leave. The band are playing Bright Crowns, the timbrels play. It's all very tonal and diatonic, but it's not a snapshot of that place as such. It only gives the perspective of the band, not the listeners or the wider scene. This had been done in classical music. Elgar wrote his Cockaigne Overture, and that was an example of trying to show the drunkenness and gluttony of late Victorian London, complete with a discordant Salvation Army band in the middle of that overture as well. But that was done in a very light-hearted way, with little focus on poverty or the work of the Christian missions. So instead, RSA took, I think, a far more daring approach in creating what I think is the Salvation Army's answer to the canon of London symphonies. So let's talk about some musical inspirations for RSA. If we're talking folk music, which is hugely important in this piece, if we're talking London symphonies, and if we're talking Ray Stedman Allen, we have to talk about Ralph Vaughan Williams. He was RSA's hero. He was the first composer he really studied in depth and is an influence in much of his writing. When I listen to RSA's music, as someone who loves Vaughan Williams' music, To me, RSA feels like an heir to Vaughan Williams, with music like Lord of the Sea and Prelude on Randolph, which is a Vaughan Williams tune, sounding like Vaughan Williams speaking through the brass band medium, perhaps even more than when Vaughan Williams wrote for brass bands himself. In considering Ratcliffe Highway, Vaughan Williams' London Symphony, written shortly before the First World War, is really significant and has a great thematic influence on Ratcliffe, as we will see. The other composer I want to mention is Charles Ives. We know from RSA's writings that as a teenager he was listening to the American composer Charles Ives, who I think is the most significant musical influence on this work. Ives also is a great model for an experimental Salvation Army composer like RSA. He's even been labelled a religious composer. He often built music towards epiphanies, like he uses the hymn tune Woodworth in his third symphony, and he does a fantasy on Nearer My God to Thee to close his fourth symphony as well. Now, Ives wrote highly programmatic music, so perfect for this. It was full of nostalgia, and his music evoked a boyhood spent in Connecticut under the tutelage of his father, George Ives, a conductor of the town brass band. And Charles Ives even described his music as being brass bands with wings on. Ives presented his listeners with exciting, exasperating, complex sound environments with tense textures, using musical collages, creating music that was spatial and pictorial, mimicking real-world historical environments. You might say sound pictures or even snapshots. Ives could knit together many tunes and tonalities at once in a similar style of pandemonium to that of Igor Stravinsky. Now, Stravinsky would disguise his Russian folk tunes in ballets like Petrushka and The Rite of Spring to the point where they were unrecognisable and also deniable by him. Ives makes the quotations and allusions in his montages clear to the listener. The most characteristic programmatic and pastiche Ives would be the second movement of a piece called Three Places in New England. And that second movement is called Putnam's Camp, where he recounts a 4th of July picnic where a child listens to the bands, joins in with the games and dances. It's rhythmically awkward, deliberately mistuned, and he uses many tunes through the movement, including Yankee Doodle and the British Grenadiers, which is used on multiple occasions and is actually the only melody that appears in all three movements of this Three Places in New England. And so in some ways, the British Grenadiers is the constant of the whole. Thinking about London Symphonies again, this is not unlike Haydn in his London Symphony. So he wrote 12 London Symphonies, which were the final 12 symphonies he wrote. And he used folk material as the element of stability in those symphonies in the 18th century. It's helping to anchor the larger structure. Ives did the same, and so did RSA, and we'll come back to this idea as well as the British Grenadiers and Yankee Doodle as we discuss Ratcliffe Highway.
And of course, the Ives connection goes the other way. Also, Charles Ives being inspired to write a piece of music around General William Booth entering into heaven. Great piece.
Absolutely.
As well.
Fantastic piece. He also wrote a string quartet. I think his first string quartet was subtitled The Salvation Army. So there's a real connection there between Ives and the Salvation Army.
Amazing. Great to make all those links. And that gives us a real terrific background to the music. So, I think it's probably about time that we delve into the piece itself. And I guess the opening would be the natural place to start.
Absolutely. And what an opening. It's violent, it's brutal. It's a 12-tone chord to open, and this is dissonance on the level of Schoenberg. And that's not unusual for RSA. He was very happy to be dissonant. If you think of Holy War, with its battle climax chord that uses all but two notes of the chromatic scale, he returned to that chord in Romans 8. The trombone concerto Immortal Theme begins with a 12-note row, and he's using here a 12-note chord with every note, white and black note from the piano in a one octave scale. And so we are straight into the violence of Ratcliffe Highway, with the foreshadowing of drunken behaviour to come in the trombone glisses. The trombones are often quite drunk in this piece. No comments there, please. The listener, especially a Salvation Army listener, is uncomfortable. I was speaking to someone about my core about this piece recently, and they said, oh, I don't like that. It makes me feel uncomfortable. Good. We should be. That's the idea of the story. There's also then, after this opening, the bar, two bars before A, there's a long pause. And then we go very, very quiet. And it's interesting, again, thinking about London symphonies, thinking about Haydn's London symphonies. This is, in essence, what we would call a noise-killing technique. And the first time that appears in classical music is in Haydn's London symphonies, where he starts really loud, sometimes just with one really loud chord, and then instantly goes quiet. And that's been passed down through the centuries since. And RSA is using that technique here. So we go into letter A, and we have fog and chimes presented in the music, very much like the opening of Vaughan Williams' London Symphony. Now, Vaughan Williams begins his symphony with rising fogs, shown by rising and falling intervals, before the Westminster chimes emerge in a harp and in the strings. The fog returns all the way through that symphony, second movement, I think, is the next time, along with a lavender call. Who will buy my blooming lavender? Now, Vaughan Williams does that in the viola, but it's obviously not played by strings in this piece. And whilst the fog and the chimes are similarly used by RSA, though far more chromatically here, he introduces the lavender theme in the opening bars, and this is going to be vital in holding together the whole structure of the piece in the same way that Ives uses the British Grenadiers in his composition. It's folk material holding together the whole, just like Haydn. Whilst the reference to Vaughan Williams' use of Westminster chimes is really quite obvious here, if you know Vaughan Williams' London Symphony and you hear it here, it's quite an obvious link. Perhaps less known would be the fact that the chimes also appear in one of Ives' string quartets, his second string quartet. So that influence of Ives is there too. From this opening snapshot, immediately as listeners, we know we're in London and we know it's the Victorian era, as this street call from a flower girl was well known as a tune of the late 1800s. The violent opening music returns and a snare drum marches us onto Ratcliffe Highway with all of its sights and sounds.
And at letter B, a couple of tunes are introduced. What can you tell us about these melodies that we assume to hear?
Well, first up, we've got Blow the Man Down, which is an 1860s sea shanty. And if you know SpongeBob SquarePants, Matthew, and I'm sure you do, the theme tune from that song is based on this shanty. And you might hear, way, hey, blow the man down. So that's going on here at letter B. The melody is presented in B-flat major, but there are flattened sevenths. The accompaniment is in C, and there is a tritone interval included in the harmony. The bass line is in another key again, as bitonality is already the norm in this piece. Lots of keys going on at the same time, melody, accompaniment, and here bass line, all in different keys. And it's going to happen again and again. Here again is the influence of Charles Ives. Now, I read a great story about him as a child. He was made to sing songs in one key whilst being accompanied by his father in another key. It's not how I spent the time with my father as a kid, but that's what Charles Ives did. Back into RSA's music, and the trombones skillfully represent the drunk sailors seeking cheap gin before we get, as you say, a second tune. And it's almost imperceptibly introduced. That tune is Goodbye Dolly Grey, which was written in 1897. And it's a song about going off to war. Goodbye Dolly, I must leave you, though it breaks my heart to go. Something tells me I'm needed at the front to fight the foe. Now, just incidentally, before we move past those two tunes, there are two folk tunes named Ratcliffe Highway. Now, neither appears in this music. The more popular of the two, which has lyrics that are not suitable for this podcast, is all about a man who, while seeking prostitutes and gin houses on the highway, finds himself press-ganged into joining the Navy at the nearby docks. And so Dolly Grey is presenting these similar themes to represent something that might happen on the highway, and so a very appropriate choice.
And we'll move swiftly on to Letter C before you start singing any verses of that aforementioned song.
Absolutely. So when we get into Letter C, we get a waltz. But it's a waltz derived from another song, London Bridge is Falling Down, which I won't sing because hopefully everyone will be familiar with it. This is a 17th century tune, but actually it became popular in the 19th century. So again, it's very appropriate for using for a piece about Ratcliffe Highway. It was originally a song about the dilapidation of London Bridge, but perhaps here is a metaphor for London itself, as our glissing trombones are continuing to cause mayhem. Also, RSA is messing around with the pulse at Letter C so that we, much like the drunkards, feel a tad unsteady on our feet. D and E, the music continues to be derived from London Bridge is Falling Down, but RSA introduces rhythmic cells from an 1830s sea shanty, What Shall We Do with a Drunken Sailor? He formally recognises it in his score notes at bar 91, presented by a chromatic fall and echoes of the opening violent music. The bar before F, we get a large crescendo from the cymbal, and our flower girl returns with Won't You Buy My Sweet Blue Lavender, coupled again with the Westminster chimes for a second time, so this is an important structural point. At G, we hear an original hymn from RSA, and it's described above the score as Over all there is a divine heart. At this point, it's as if God is surveying the carnage of the highway we've heard so far and lamenting the scene with a divine yearning for transformation for those there. The falling thirds and fourths give this a real sighing, depressed feel with a pedal in the bass and very ambiguous harmony. We hear questions being asked. What should we do with a drunken sailor? What should we do with a drunken sailor? It keeps being asked by the band. And RSA describes this moment in the music as bitter, coarse, vivacious, and mournful with the emotions of human wreckage. Say that he was born in the East End himself. He lived in London during the Blitz of early World War II. He served as a sailor. He knew what violence and suffering would sound like on the streets of London, and he's achieving that here. There's also a sense this is a groan from the people of the highway themselves. Perhaps they aren't really living the high life. They're suffering a bit of a hollow existence. The previously drunk trombones cry out with a motif we'll hear later in the piece. Bum, 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 ba-dum. The lament is gradually passed all the way from soprano to B-flat bass, as if all of heaven is weeping before we return to the sounds of the street once more, a few bars before letter I. Now, if I take you to the modern day highway, half hidden down a small pedestrian path called Grace's Alley, a short way between Cable Street and the highway, is one of the East End's gems and the world's oldest surviving grand music hall, Wilton's Music Hall. Now, music halls and their songs were incredibly popular with the working class, and the Salvation Army makes an appearance in several songs. You've Got a Long Way to Go and 'Twas a Thing She'd Never Done Before are two that come to mind. Champagne Charlie himself, or George Laybourne to use his proper name, performed at Wilton's, and one song almost certainly performed would have been Sweet Genevieve. It was a music hall tune composed in the 1860s by George Cooper. Now, this has nothing to do with Sweet Caroline. It's a very different content. It's a man grieving for his dead wife, a man shrouded in dark thoughts and loss. Oh, Genevieve, I'd give the world to live again this lovely past. The cornet's whisper, a muted and highly chromatic presentation before more questions of what to do with drunk sailors, take us into an entirely new sound world and snapshot at letter I. So now we arrive at letter I. But first, let me tell you, Matthew, about the Russian philosopher and author Dostoevsky. I don't know how much time you spent reading his writing.
Oh, almost every day.
I bet. He visited London in 1862, and I have done some reading of his writing, and he noted the extraordinary easy communion that there was between rich and poor on the streets of London. And actually, I talked about Charles Booth earlier and his poverty map. And if you look at where the Salvation Army barracks were on Whitechapel Road, just a short journey north up Cannon Street Road from the highway, we see right next to this abject poverty, great affluence. They're living side by side. And so at letter I in Ratcliffe Highway, we now have a moment where alongside Seeming Abyss trots a horse and a carriage. RSA clearly took inspiration from the third movement of Vaughan Williams' London Symphony with its reference to hansom cabs and with imaginative use of jingling percussion. Note the sleigh bells, and actually just note in general the complexity and variety of the percussion writing if you compare it with Holy War 13, 14 years earlier, for example. As these sleigh bells vainly trot along, it's as if everyone on the highway is on their best behaviour, with the only interruption to the procession another lavender call in the back row cornets and horns. The chromatic stepwise motif of the carriage moves to the B-flat bass before gradually being taken over again by a subtle slowing down and the return of the passionate lament and groans of the highway, now that deference has been made to the shallow betters of Victorian society who leave all of this devastation behind them. Forlorn questions continue of what to do with a drunken sailor, and the rhythmic cell that's derived from that sea shanty is used as well. And it appears one bar before K in the trombones and timpani, taking us to letter K.
And much like the River Thames, the music meanders into a new section. Where are we in the narrative at section K?
Well, K is for carnage. I know that as a primary school teacher, I shouldn't say that. That's not right. But it really is. K is for carnage. Carnage ensues here. And what shall we do with a drunken sailor is given its first full, robust and rampant run out. It's in D flat, talking in concert pitch, at a brisk crotchet tempo of 152. We've added sevenths. There's flattened thirds to rock the tonality. Baritones and bass have the opportunity to shout, way, hey, up she rises for the first time too. You'll hear that. The band rises chromatically together and the solo cornets remind us of our dilapidated city with London bridges falling down as the drunks return to violence at letter L, coarsely glissing around in the trombones against yet more 12-note chords of anguish. References to Drunken Sailor are then interrupted by a cornet fanfare in the key of E-flat. And this is as a group of soldiers arrive, whilst in D, the song It's the Soldiers of the Queen, My Lads, is played heavily in the bass end against the snare drum and first cornet line echoing the Drunken Sailor tune still. All of these layers on top of each other in different keys, different tunes. This all brings us to our first invented, if very plausible, event. A drunken fight occurs on the highway.
What happens in this fight? Can you describe the musical chaos that we hear?
An Englishman, an Irishman, and an American walk into a bar. The beginning of a very funny joke, I hear you ask, Matthew. No, it's letter M and N and some of the best narrative writing ever seen in a brass band score. Firstly, the tune I mentioned in the last episode in reference to Charles Ives, the British Grenadiers, appears in the soprano and xylophone in different keys, accompanied by discord and clashes. The tune segues into the E-flat bass before a crescendo to the question, what shall we do with a drunken sailor early in the morning? At bar 188, the answer comes in the form of a short two-bar reference to another music hall song, Knock 'em Down the Old Kent Road. At letter N, the Irishman arrives in the form of the jig Irish Washerwoman, played harmoniously in the euphonium and baritone, before the solo horn goes somewhat off-key and the back row cornets interject, trying to sell their lavender again. Hopefully you remember that from the last episode.
Classic back row behaviour as well.
Absolutely. Very true. Last to arrive is the American in the cornets and the xylophone. The arrival of the American provokes a punch being thrown. No comments, please, about Americans. My grandma was American. No comments. And the word thump is written in the score. Whilst it's unclear who throws the first punch and who was struck, it is signified by an 11-part chord. Now, this 11-part chord, looking at it, is much like the final chord of Ives' Second Symphony, so maybe the fist was American. Only a G natural at concert pitch is missing. Now, I want you to remember that for later, that the G is missing. It's the only note missing from that thump chord. Here is some of the most obtuse counterpoint of the whole piece, with multiple tunes in multiple keys. I'll try and talk you through them all. The basses move between references to Yankee Doodle and the Soldiers of the Queen. The euphonium continues its Irish jig over the top, whilst the horns are barking out Yankee Doodle before joining with the baritone in yet another lavender motif, as the back row take over Yankee Doodle. Meanwhile, from nowhere, a cornet fanfare of Hearts of Yoke, which at the time was the official anthem of the British Navy, sounds out. It's unclear whether the Navy have arrived to observe or to join in with the melee. The trombones drunkenly slide into the return of four more thumps, six bars before O, repeated with the same 11-part chord as before, so no G in there, with Yankee Doodle interjections or pleas between each. We hear two bars of the trombone's violent motif from the very opening, this time in the basses, as a trill in the cornets holds us in suspense to see who will win the fight. Two bars before O, the trill is released, and the trombones declare a three-part figure we have not heard since letter C, taken from London Bridge is Falling Down, and the waltz derived from that. And perhaps here, one of the men really has fallen down. A last reference to Yankee Doodle on a diminuendo in the basses takes us to letter O, and a chance to recover and reflect on the barbaric spectacle we've just witnessed.
Of course, the question that's on everyone's lips is, who won the fight? Do we find out?
Well, the listener can decide, but a sorrowful reference to the mid-19th century American sea shanty Shenandoah in the baritone, coupled with those interjections of Yankee Doodle between punches, suggests to me the American has not come out well and may well be showing signs of homesickness and remorse. The London Bridge is Falling Down reference that's given in a 5-4 bar that follows could be the American flailing on the floor, or even a representation of the British soldier himself being beaten up. Perhaps the luck of the Irish prevailed. Both ways, it's a lamentable scene, and so we return to RSA's lament melody at letter P. This time, though, the sighing that we referenced in the lament previously, the falling thirds of the lament actually rise. There are forward-moving triplets in the bass, and a glimmer of hope emerges as Whitechapel Salvation Army Band, one of London's first bands, enter the scene, led by the low brass and then solo horn, singing the 1878 hymn We'll Be Heroes, a very appropriate choice with the piece being written and premiered in 1978. The words are heavily influenced by warfare and battle-like language, reminiscent of some scripture passages in Revelation chapter 12. It's muscular Christianity of a Victorian vintage. We'll be heroes. We'll be heroes when the battle is fierce. When the raging storm louder increase, will our courage increase by the cross. The verse concludes with a really beautiful quintet setting with muted, drunken snarls continuing around these courageous early day salvationists. A sudden tempo shift to allegro brings us face to face with a single drunk at letter R singing the 1868 music hall classic Champagne Charlie. There are many versions of these lyrics, but Champagne Charlie is my name, Champagne Charlie is my game, good for any game at night, my boys, who'll come and join me in a spree. That's just one version. As the drunk first trombone part flutter tongues us into letter S, grace notes are introduced and the singing gets more vulgar, the trombones, again unsurprisingly, to the fore. Meanwhile, the Whitechapel band whisper phrases from another Victorian hymn written in 1870, Hold the Fort, a song inspired by the American Civil War and historically authenticated as being played by Salvation Army bands at the time. At letter T, the bass line shows our drunk becoming a little unsteady on their feet, in RSA's words, with the pulse disguised between pianissimo staccato voices.
So that takes us to letter U. What does the music tell us here in this section?
At U, the bass line continues to stumble, whilst the army band, represented by the cornets, give a full verse and chorus setting of Hold the Fort at a piano level and marked as the little band, perhaps small in number and awaiting reinforcements. Ho, my comrades, see the signal waving in the sky, reinforcements now appearing, victory is nigh. Hold the fort, for I am coming. Jesus signals still, wave the answer back to heaven. By thy grace we will. Now, early day salvationists took secular songs like Champagne Charlie and set soul-saving words to them in an attempt to attract the working classes. Here's to rum and whiskey, drink them down, drink them down. That becomes Storm the Forts of Darkness, for example. Less known would be the musical song I Ain't Going to Tell, which the army adopted as I Ain't Going to Hell. Well, for Champagne Charlie, read Bless His Name, He Sets Me Free. It's been suggested that for the drunk, there is also a struggle here between the two sets of words, and two additional references are made at forte level by the drunk. The first shares the same D-flat key as Hold the Fort, so it's suggesting that he's singing the words, Bless His Name, He Sets Me Free. The second reference, though, moves into B-flat, creating discord with the band, and rather than him singing, Oh the blood, the precious blood, I am trusting in the cleansing flood, we're actually hearing more references to Champagne Charlie. Three bars before V, the band are in more confident voice, perhaps joined by reinforcements as indicated in the war cry article by the Jolly Major. Let me read that to you. The Major writes, "At 10:30, a lot of people were seen rushing up Cannon Street, and someone said, 'Oh, the army is coming.' And so it proved. Our comrades from Shoebriness, Barking, Stratford, Poplar, Canning Town, Enfield Wash, Grays, Ilford, Ponders End, Romford, Waltham Abbey, and all round that district, led on by Staff Captain Noyce, made no small stir as the Whitechapel Soldiers' Band met them with a shout, as of warriors going to battle." And so we have our reinforcements. However, we never hear the final word of the chorus, "By thy grace we will." Will doesn't get said, suggesting a nervousness from the band or an interruption from the drunk. And so clearly this would remind us of Leslie Condon's The Present Age, where he's unable to say "deny thee never" in his setting of "I'll follow thee." Present Age was written 10 years before Ratcliffe Highway, and RSA did a lot of writing about that piece and how inspired he was by the levels of dissonance and the creativity. So interesting that that technique is used by RSA here. So we arrive at letter V. If the Whitechapel band were indeed nervous as they marched down the highway, they and other Salvationists at the time had reason to be. 3 years earlier, the confrontations between the Skeleton Army and Worthing Band reached the national press, back in September 1883 and again in April 1884. Soot and chamber pot contents were thrown over bandsmen, while those supporting them, like a local businessman called George Hand, had their property burned down and were even arrested. At one point, Salvationists were walking around Worthing armed for protection from the locals, with the police reluctant to interfere and the establishment worried over a movement, the Salvation Army, that could produce a group of sober, upright workers who might demand proper pay and adequate conditions. In Worthing, the Riot Act was read for the only time in the town's history. Mass brawls broke out not just there, though, but in 67 towns and villages, with thousands of Salvation Army officers injured and hundreds of army buildings damaged. Fast forward to the 1930s. RSA's parents were stationed in Worthing, and that scene of these Skeleton Army attacks. As a boy, he attended the 50th anniversary of the Corps and witnessed the presentation of the original blood-stained Corps flag encased in glass, and I know that it's still there as well. RSA is likely then to have heard first-hand stories of these encounters from Corps folk, and Reformed Skeleton Army member and leader for the weekend, British Commissioner Charles Jeffreys. He was the equivalent of the modern-day Territorial Commander. He was also one of the Skeleton Army's early ringleaders as a 16-year-old. He was a captain within the Skeleton Army in the Whitechapel branch and was well known for disrupting Salvation Army public meetings and assaulting soldiers and officers. One officer at the time, one Salvation Army officer, Colonel George Holmes, vividly recalled one incident he witnessed as a boy in 1881. "It was very rough. I remember attending an open-air meeting one Sunday night outside the Blind Beggar pub. Afterwards, we marched to our hall on Whitechapel Road. The Skeletons, directed by Charles Jeffreys, headed our procession, proceeding at a snail's pace and compelling us to do so. Thus handicapped, we were jostled and pelted with decayed fruit and mud." Ironically, the same Charles Jeffreys was converted at one of the very meetings he tried to disrupt at Whitechapel Salvation Army, alongside over 20 other members of the Skeletons. And this provides us then with a link between the Whitechapel band of the 1880s and an 11-year-old RSA in the 1930s. And RSA's recollection of that Worthing Corps anniversary weekend where he met Commissioner Jeffreys states that a sense of persecution of early-day Salvationists was embedded in his mind for the rest of his life. All of what I've just said about Charles Jeffreys and the skeletons provides context to the second imagined event introduced by RSA at letter V, a confrontation between the drunk and the Salvation Army band.
Some amazing stories there, and great to hear a bit of that history. Where are we up to in the music?
Well, we've reached letter V. The musical inspiration here comes again from Charles Ives, or perhaps from his father, George. George was an experimenter for whom any combination of notes were allowed, as long as there is a reason for it. He allegedly once marched two bands towards each other for the sheer thrill of the cacophony. As they approached each other, they would play louder and louder, creating acute dissonance and a collision of tunes. Now, that's not unlike Wilfred Heaton's concert march Glory Glory, which was inspired by the collision of a Salvation Army band and a bugle band in his childhood. So there are a couple of examples of this in Salvation Army music. Ives used this technique in the aforementioned in previous podcasts, Three Places in New England, also including Drunks Rambling and Stumbling, whilst in the first movement of that piece, he depicts soldiers marching in mud in a similar way to how RSA shows our drunk on the highway to be unsteady on their feet. The confrontation at letter V in Ratcliffe Highway begins quietly as the drunk continues to be unsteady on their feet and quietly sings Champagne Charlie in B flat. Against this, the band begins Hold the Fort in D-flat, crescendoing on the words, reinforcements now appearing as the many bands join united, and I referenced many bands in that War Cry article. The drunk shouts still louder, the tonalities and ways of life clashing as we pass into letter W and a forte. Both songs complete, the band and drunk repeat the choruses, screaming over the top of each other at fortissimo now, before accelerating with the words, back to heaven, over and over, before in fact we return to the hell of the music of the very opening at letter X, complete with all 12 tones and the vulgar, callous, glissing trombones. A unison thump of C brings the confrontation to a sudden and ugly conclusion. At Y, our flower girl returns at an andante tempo. But unlike the previous stately statements of this lavender motif, it is not followed by the Westminster chimes, as RSA takes us into the most passionate statement of his lament yet, sung at fortissimo. And just to remind you, that lament is entitled Over All There Is a Divine Heart. The question of what to do with the drunken sailor is wailed in the trombones. However, the lament is again inverted to rising thirds at a mezzo forte, which gives us a moderate sense of hope and things looking up, with the triplet accompaniment of the basses earlier returning. Is the band arriving? RSA shuffles his cards again and places a short reference to the Westminster chimes here. Why? Because the time of victory for the Salvationists and their Christian message has arrived.
For those following along with the score, we're now at section AA.
At AA, Whitechapel Salvation Army Band explodes into a thrilling G major unrivaled setting of Hold the Fort. As an intro introduction to the enlightened conclusion via a slowing down to present another setting of We'll Be Heroes in all its glory, using these words: we shall conquer through the blood of the Lamb. We will never retreat though we die till the conquest we've won by the cross. The return of We'll Be Heroes feels like an Ivesian epiphany. Victory is at hand for God's marching band. The cry of the trombones from the earlier lament is triumphantly transformed as a proud cry of victory in the solo cornet, underpinned by a jubilant bass line. At CC, following the epiphany, many of the tunes collide as if the many figures of the highway are following the band back to the hall for tea. And following the band back to the hall for tea is referenced again by the Joyful Major in their article. Blow the Man Down comes first, with references to Sweet Genevieve chromatically disguised in the flugel, solo horn, first trombone and euphonium. The jubilant bass line of BB that I just referenced moves into the trombones as demanding semiquavers as part of a rallentando. At bar 379, a subito piano and allegando introduces references to the earlier London Bridge waltz that grows into an ostinato figure relentless in pushing forward and joined by a final reference to the Westminster chimes 5 before DD. The chimes returning at the work's conclusion aligns with the end of Vaughan Williams' London Symphony. In Vaughan Williams' symphony, Westminster chimes are fading into the fog, almost as if passing away in an ominous prediction of the loss of World War I that was to come shortly after. However, there's no emulation of a muted ending by RSA. Rather, the far more joyful chimes in the trombone section charge us to a new day and to victory over the injustices seen on the streets of London by the glory of the cross. Whatever empires or cities may rise or fall or become wrecks of time, Jesus' victory and God's kingdom stand forever. The trombone section and snare drum rhythmically remind us of What Shall We Do With a Drunken Sailor, but all sense of lamentation has been shaken off as a final reminder of London Bridge's falling down takes us to two bars before EE. We have the final return of the lavender motif, this time with great strength in unison and octaves, starting on the first beat in the bar rather than with an anacrusis. We see now that this piece structurally is built around this folk song, just like Haydn did with his London symphonies, and that it has returned over and over to hold the piece together, just like Ives used the British Grenadiers in his Three Places in New England. For me, it's as if the question has become more than just who will buy my flowers. As we return to the army barracks, we ask, who will sign up and follow? Who will buy into this ministry of salvation? Lavender, of course, also has a significance in the Bible, something that can be used to purify and heal. Forgiveness and redemption are at hand here for those on the highway. The excruciating chords of the next bar could be the difficulty that we all face in committing our lives and knowing that some will turn their backs on the offer. A bar later, the Deciso announces a clear intention from many to follow Jesus as a ransomed, healed and restored Christian. Now, maybe this poem, written by RSA just a year after his composition, which details walking through London, reveals some of his imagination for both the piece and especially the ending as our heroes march onward. So this poem is called Glory March. On rare occasions, I go home northward by Paul's Cathedral. One early evening, Friday dulled, trudging the churchyard route on impulse, whimsical snippet of thought no more, I headed an imaginary march. The lilt of music in my brain would square the shoulders, sharpen up the pace. An idle fancy, scarce projected, instantly in my mind created. Flags ablaze with God's tricolour, and at the back of me skilled musicians, compact, clear, precise and crisp, play martial tunes that lift the step. Buoyant, silver sparkling bands, salvation soldiers, numberless as the sands, past the grey church stones we swing, reinforcements crowding in, saints and martyrs, loved, forgiven, ransomed souls, task force of heaven, holy colours, streaming brave, say Jesus lives and lives to save. I left the church path through the gate, my spirit soaring, grown elate, burning with a sense of mission, glowing with a Patmos vision. The underground became a shrine on the westbound central line. So that was taken from a stroll home to Barnet, or making his way home to the tube to get to Barnet, in 1979, the year after he had written Ratcliffe Highway. Now, all of that interpretation stuff that I've mentioned there, which I suppose is my interpretation or my interpretation of RSA's programme notes, isn't the only interpretation out there. Professor Stephen Allen from America has written quite a lot about Ratcliffe Highway, and he hears Newton's hymns, Glorious Things of Thee Are Spoken, set to Haydn's Austria hymn, Glorious Things of Thee Are Spoken, which is very similar to Who Will Buy My Pretty Lavender, whichever word you want to use for that motif. Now, RSA never named it as such. Allen also thinks that bar with the excruciating chords is some kind of exorcism or conversion taking place. Again, not mentioned by RSA, but there is a sense here that all of the events of the War Cry article are coming to pass, with folks being forgiven and turning their lives to Jesus, just as Charles Jeffreys did in Whitechapel back in the 1880s. Interesting to note the different interpretations, though, as it shows that programmatic music is still full of room for personal reflection and interpretation. Remember the lady from the first episode in the War Cry article who heard the band, didn't know the words to the song they were playing, but to her it said, "Come back to God, God can make you happy," and the band managed to prevent her suicide. It didn't matter whether or not they were the words actually associated with the music. We've talked a lot about Vaughan Williams, and he was really worried that the London Symphony would have been seen as programmatic, and that it had, in his view, it needed to be absolute music. However, Charles Ives, the other main inspiration on this piece, argued for program music as surely it's just absolute music with subheadings. In fact, if we look at the history of classical music and the most revolutionary music written, it's mostly been programmatic in every era. So, if you go right back to Monteverdi's Vespers, program music. The Eroica Symphony, program music. The Rite of Spring, program music. Three places in New England, just to name a few. As a Salvation Army, we have the greatest stories to tell, so perhaps we need more program music. We shouldn't be too scared or too ignorant to not share the word association of our music with our listeners. It doesn't narrow the possibilities of their response. It simply gives them a starting point or a framework. Whether you are a 19th century prostitute or a modern day musicologist, you can respond and interpret for yourself as you want to, or hopefully as the Holy Spirit leads you to. And RSA actually said, you've got to believe the Holy Spirit will translate the unknowable in music. If Jesus is a teacher, he's an interpreter too. So everyone, when you're playing your pieces, get your words on the screen. Back to Ratcliffe Highway, and the close is powerful. There's a likeness to, again, Haydn's London Symphonies with a kind of a populist finish. RSA knew a Salvation Army audience, and he knew what kind of ending they would want at an occasion like 100 years of Salvation Army banding being celebrated. The music is in line with the muscular evangelism of the early army and the revival meetings of Charles Ives' youth, as all the voices join together in huge organ-like chords, bright fanfare figures, and that jubilant bass line of We'll Be Heroes, which went into the trombones, is now transformed into the cornets. Earlier in the piece, the lament figure passed all the way from the soprano to the bass, as if heaven was weeping over the scene. Here, in the latter half of the piece, the jubilant figure has risen through the basses, through the trombones, and onto the cornets as heaven rejoices and we're being lifted up to God. The euphonia reminds us that the early day salvationists truly were heroes, with another reference to "we'll be heroes," and maybe alludes to the fact that we can all be heroes who can conquer through the cross of Christ who has overcome the world. Now, do you remember the note missing from the 11-note thump in that earlier fistfight? It was a unison G. And at the end of this piece, a unison G crashes down in unity and strength to end the work. Now, the question I've been asking as I've been looking at the score, is this deliberate? Well, I certainly wouldn't put that level of detail past the great Ray Steadman Allen. And so ends one of the most remarkable works in all brass band literature, and the Salvation Army's very own London Symphony.
About 150 years, what message can we take away from this music for our society we find ourselves in today?
Okay, well, let's talk about the music first. I think RSA takes army music to a new height with this work. I love it because it's daring and it's experimental. It stands up next to the artistry of Charles Ives, Ralph Vaughan Williams, and other musical giants. So when I listen to this music, I'm reminded of the rich musical heritage we have as a movement through composers like RSA, with their musical adventures that introduce techniques and sounds from the 20th century mainstream into their Salvation Army work. His use of the collage technique inspired by Ives just leaves me in awe, especially in the way that he knits the tunes and their opposing tonalities together in a way that suggests they've always belonged together. The craftsmanship is exceptional, and even if some tunes are unknown to you, the snapshots are vividly unmistakable. And it remains today still a great challenge as a player and as a listener. And the last time I had the fortune to be on staff with the Territorial Youth Band, just before the pandemic in 2020, we played this, and the kids absolutely loved it. I hope our composers today continue to be brave in our concert music and continue to push barriers whilst using recognisable tunes and a well-honed craft too. I also think, though, that secondly, this music is about connecting with culture. RSA said he felt Salvation Army music needed to be steeped in biblical truths, and the principle of adapting methods and means to communicate effectively in different cultural settings is seen in the Bible. It's seen in the book of Acts. As the first apostles learned to speak new languages, both linguistically and culturally, in order to express the gospel. Now, back in the 19th century, in William Booth's opinion, Christianity appeared to make absolutely no difference to the lives of Victorians in the East End. Booth was scathing of the churches of the day for practicing their worship in ways that failed to connect with working class culture. It's why they ditched hymns and organs and replaced them with popular instruments and songs set to the tunes of secular music, worshipping in skating rinks, dance halls and theatres, these sites of working class cultures. And I'm going to quote here from Captain Callum McKenna, who's done a little bit of writing about how we connect music with culture. The challenge for the contemporary Salvation Army comes, I think, as we consider the question, in what ways does our worshipping life today connect with those in our surrounding communities? It's easy with the passing of time for the stuff of our worship, the songs, the instruments, the style, to become the thing that we hold on to tightly without realising it's no longer connecting with the people we're trying to reach. We need to be prepared to let go of our own preferences in worship for the greater missional good. Now, in response to that, I could go on at length as to why we still need Salvation Army bands as part of that and how well they can relate to their communities. But we also must be ready to adapt in what we play and where we play too. Another quote here from RSA: "We are serving a higher power and may need to modify our musical language. Almost the only things that stay the same are the spiritual facts of life. The Salvation Army itself needs to consider, in my opinion, how it resources its musicians to be as effective on a street corner as we can be on a Sunday morning. We came into being to play outside, and we need more help to do so at a local level in an effective way in the age of copyright. Let's not forget that Vaughan Williams and Ives, who are England and America's greatest symphonists, wrote music based on folk, hymns and the sounds of the street. So if it's good enough for them, it should be good enough for us. And lastly, I'm also reminded by this piece that ours has been a church full of social justice heroes right from our beginnings. That we belong on the streets serving the needy, whatever their affliction or need. Think of William Booth's In Darkest England manifesto for social reform in 1891, his support for the matchstick girls or the raising of the age of consent. Incidentally, it was a Salvation Army band that marched the petition for the change to the age of consent to Parliament. Salvation Army music, too, has always had a sense of protest about it and has provided a soundtrack for the Army's war against all that stops people from experiencing life in all its fullness in Christ. Within our tradition, music then is a motivator, and it's still motivating today. 2016, during the Syrian migration crisis, a special carol service was organised outside the UK Parliament, complete with a Salvation Army band. When churches joined together in 2023 to march against climate change, they were led by a Salvation Army band. The Music Man Project in Lee is changing the lives of disabled people for the better. I'm excited for what injustice an army band will fight against next. What will it be? Joining a pride march? Protesting against human trafficking and harmful government proposed laws in Parliament Square? Supporting Black Lives Matter protests? I hope so, and I'd be interested to know what people think too.
Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for all the research that you've gone through and put into that analysis. It really is hugely appreciated and has kept me on the edge of my seat throughout as we've journeyed through Victorian London with you, but also into our society today. Thank you for giving us your interpretation as well and making it so relevant for us today as we listen. Before we go, do you want to just summarise and conclude everything that you've said?
Yeah, and I know it's been several episodes, and maybe something to sum up would be helpful. You see, for me, this piece of music is not so much a story of what the Salvation Army did 150 years ago, amazing though that was, and important for us to know and to understand. This piece is our church's past, our present, and our future, to be Jesus in our communities. In the War Cry article I mentioned, Corps No. 1 Poplar is mentioned as one of the bands who provided reinforcement with Hold the Fort. And they're still doing it at that corps. They're serving the homeless, they're running food banks, and they're shining the love of Christ with relevance to their locality. Think about what snapshots we could take in our world today. Climate change, refugee crisis, homophobia, gender inequality, addictions, food banks, racism, homelessness, human trafficking, war, and millions of people still living in poverty. As Christians and as Salvationists, these things should make us uncomfortable and make us want to act and be heroes whose victory is not through us but by the cross, pointing the way to Jesus, whatever music we are using to get that job done. Forget Victorian, go beyond London. These are 2024 snapshots. And we need an army and Salvation Army bands who are ready to fight to get our hands dirty by connecting with our culture as our forebears did. Or, as if you remember back to the first episode, as Charles Ives put it, to be a Salvation Army brass band with angelic wings on who save souls and grow the kingdom.
Amazing. Thank you so much again, Jonathan. Here is a complete performance of Ray Steadman Allen's On Ratcliffe Highway, taken from the ISB's 2005 CD, Origins.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.